Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you, Stephanie, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, Living with Myelofibrosis, and this is part two of this series, Coping with the Stress of Caregiving When Your Loved One Has Myelofibrosis. And this is this whole program is being done as part of Myelofibrosis Awareness Campaign, and so we're delighted to be able to offer this two-part series. Many of you were on the first series, which was just an overview of myelofibrosis, and today we're going to focus really on caregiving issues and myelofibrosis. We have on the program today over 374 participants, and you come from all of the United States, from many different parts of the United States, and we also have international participants from Venezuela, from the United Kingdom, from China, and Korea. So you really come from all over the world, and it's really a credit to all of you that you've chosen to spend the next hour with us. Now, I'd like to acknowledge that today's program and this entire series, has been made possible by a grant from Insight Corporation, and I really want to thank them for their support of this program. And today's program is really a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, and it's really because of our extensive outreach to all of you and because of your interest in this topic that we've been able to reach so many of you. Now, you did receive from Cancer Care materials about the program today, and in those materials there was information about our speakers and the topics they're covering, and there also was an evaluation form, and I would ask you to all take a moment at the end of today's program and complete that evaluation form. When you think about it, who but each of you can really tell us the topics you'd like us to offer moving forward, particularly focusing on myelofibrosis or other issues that you're confronting as you live with cancer. And I would say that we had done a program on myelofibrosis last year, and many of you had asked us to do a program specific for caregiving as well, so we do try to listen very carefully to your recommendations. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker, and our first speaker is Dr. Serdan Firzdovec. And Dr. Firzdovec is a chief section for MPN, a myeloproliferative neoplasms, leukemia department, clinical research center MPN, the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. And Dr. Firzdovec is going to address overview of myelofibrosis and communicating with the healthcare team about quality of life concerns. Dr. Firzdovec?
Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to join you today for this excellent summary of myelofibrosis and how to go about living with myelofibrosis and what to do. My task in next 6 minutes will be first to give you a little short overview of the disease itself and characteristics of the disease and how to communicate with the healthcare team about it. Myelofibrosis is one of the chronic diseases of the bone marrow that usually affects the people in late 60s, early 70s. And it is rather a rare disease. It is believed that in the United States, one new case is diagnosed among 100,000 population, which would say that about 3,000 new patients are diagnosed every year with myelofibrosis in the United States. This is the disease that is chronic in nature, and it goes in the group of larger chronic diseases, which are called myeloproliferative diseases. Myeloid stands always for the bone marrow cells, and proliferative, as the name implies, means that cells grow without control. There are different types of myeloproliferative diseases, and some are more benign than the others, and usually the name derives from the affected cell type in the blood that grows without control. For example, if the platelets grow without control and others are normal, this disease is called essential thrombocythemia, or ET. If other cells grow, like red blood cells, platelets, and white cells without control, this is then called polycythemia vera, or PV. In myelofibrosis, all cells grow without control, but what happens here is that rather rapidly, the bone marrow environment, the cells in the bone marrow that support the growth of malignant cells, react to the presence of growing malignant cells by producing some proteins. We measure them, actually, in the bone marrow and blood. These are called cytokines. And it is believed that these cytokines lead to a formation of a scarring tissue in the bone marrow This is what we call fibrosis, the same type of scarring tissue that one has on the skin when you cut yourself and you have a scar. The same type of scarring becomes present rather rapidly in the bone marrow of patients with myelofibrosis as a reaction to the presence of malignant cells. And this scarring progressively, unfortunately, gets worse. The body reacts to this scarring of the bone marrow in a different way. Many patients would develop very big spleen. About 80% of the patients would develop very big spleen. It is believed that in the spleen, some of the bone marrow cells actually grow. And indeed, if you have a splenectomy, if the spleen is removed in patients with very big spleen for symptom control, one would find a bone marrow in the spleen. It is believed that perhaps that bone marrow even produced some blood. About 40% of the patients may have a very big liver. The blood count, of course, is affected greatly with the disease of the bone marrow. Almost every patient over time will become anemic. The red blood cells will go down, and maybe about one-third of the patients will become blood transfusion dependent. The white cells and platelets in the blood can change. They can be high, and eventually they will become very low. Also, in the blood, we see many of the bone marrow types of cells. So the bone marrow is full of fibers and pushes bone marrow cells into the blood, and you see bone marrow cells in the blood. Very unusual picture that, unfortunately, does get worse over time and affects the body and the person who has the disease quite significantly. Clinically, we have several then problems that we deal with. The number one problem is enlargement of the big organs, spleen and liver, as mentioned, that bring early satiety, weight loss, because the spleen would press on the stomach and one would not be able to eat. So weight loss comes in, inability to exercise, to bend. Even the pain in the belly can become significant. The next problem is anemia. Transfusion dependency, hemosynemia, as I mentioned. Anemia on its own brings fatigue, frequent visits to the hospital for blood transfusions and blood checking. And then constitutional symptoms. These are symptoms that affect body in general. We are talking about the low-grade fever, bone aches and pains, itching, night sweating. In addition, one would have this significant weight loss, so the functioning of the body and role of the person in the society decreases, the activity level decreases overall. This part of the disease, the overall decrease in the activity level and constitutional symptoms are believed to be caused by the cytokines I mentioned that are produced in the bone marrow as a part of the disease process. We have good evidence that myelofibrosis, apart from affecting the growth of the cells, these cells grow without control, also provides very high levels of inflammatory proteins in blood. So inflammation is a significant part of the disease process, and this is what causes many of these constitutional symptoms that I mentioned. Significant development in the understanding of the disease process have been done or has happened a few years ago. 7 years ago, there was a discovery in a mutational of one gene called JAK2 or JAK2, which was found to be mutated in about half of the patients with myelofibrosis. At that time, in 2005, we thought that the JAK2 mutation that leads to an abnormal mutated JAK2 enzyme, which is present in bone marrow cells, it's responsible mutation for the disease, and that we would be able to perhaps develop JAK2 mutation-specific medications and eliminate disease. Since then, we learned that in addition to JAK2 mutation, patients with myelofibrosis may have many other mutations. I think at the last count, we have evidence for more than 20 mutations being identified in patients with myelofibrosis, and one patient may have multiple mutations present in their malignant cells at the same time. Even a further complicated picture emerges when one tries to identify what would be the first of the many, what would be the one that would actually cause the disease. This is really unknown. We are at the a very intensive part of a discovery in myelofibrosis, but we don't really have a knowledge what is the cause. there are multiple mutations contributing to the disease existence and progression, including the JAK2 mutation, but none of this is really the cause. We are also, based on this knowledge, developing new therapies that Dr. Ruben Messel will review for us a little bit later, and it is exciting time, not just in the discovery phase, but in the clinical development of new therapies. Now, in the everyday management, it is very important to understand what disease actually does to a patient and how this quality of life part that I sporadically mentioned is really of clinical concern for one suffering from myelofibrosis. Unfortunately, many of my colleagues, including me, sometimes don't have too much time to spend with the patient because of clinical burden, but it is very important to spend time and to understand the quality of life issues and ask the patients and convey the message, perhaps in the other way around, from the patient to a physician on what symptoms patients suffer from, including insomnia, inactivity, fatigue, itching, bone pains. Too many times we are too quick in asking question, how are you today? And the answer is, oh, I'm doing relatively okay, without any further questioning what actually is the problem, how can we help, what are the problems, and how the therapies that we now have may help you improve your quality of life and make life better, enjoyable, and perhaps not even with elimination of disease, but just controlling disease signs and symptoms would be clinically relevant. With that, I would give a next opportunity to Dr. Ruben Messer to tell us more on the treatment options that we have for patients with myelofibrosis.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Vistovic, for a wonderful overview of myelofibrosis and also for that very important tip for everybody that really any symptom, any concern should be really discussed with their physician during those visits, and that's really important. So thank you. I know we're repeating that throughout, but that's such an important information for everybody to take away. And our next speaker is Dr. Ruben Messer. Dr. Messer is Chair, Division of Hematology and Medical Oncology, Professor of Medicine, Mayo Clinic, Arizona. And Dr. Messer is going to address current treatment options and caring for your loved one with myelofibrosis. Dr. Messer.
So, well, thank you very much, Carolyn, and for those affected by the horrible storm this week, certainly know that all of us around the country are very much thinking of you and hoping for a speedy recovery. Now, picking up where my esteemed colleague and good friend Serge Vistovic left off, patients who are afflicted with myelofibrosis, you know, exist on a spectrum, but can be individuals that really can suffer from some unique and difficult aspects with the disease. And many of you as caregivers for these individuals frequently struggle with the concepts of, you know, how best do we help them. So I'm hopeful that this call with all of us involved today will give you some tools that will be helpful in caring for your loved one who has myelofibrosis. Now, the treatment options, I would say, for this disease really exist on a spectrum. And why they exist on a spectrum is because patients with myelofibrosis themselves exist on a spectrum. On one end of the spectrum, perhaps the earliest forms of myelofibrosis, patients can be more mildly affected with the disease. They might have their spleen be enlarged and may or may not have symptoms from that. They may or may not have anemia. They may or may not have other constitutional symptoms. The other extreme can be individuals who are significantly affected, who can have a large spleen, feel poorly, and have a disease that can be quite problematic, needing transfusions, or even be life-threatening. So depending upon where an individual is on that spectrum has an impact on what sort of treatment we choose. So when they visit with someone who focuses on MPN, such as Dr. Vistovic, myself, or many of our colleagues around the country, we look at the options that exist on a spectrum. On one end of the spectrum, the least risk and the least reward is really to observe the disease. There are some times that we will find the disease in its earliest forms. People are relatively asymptomatic, they may be young, and we may watch the disease for a period of time. The other end of the spectrum is bone marrow transplantation. Bone marrow transplantation can potentially cure myelofibrosis as it can cure other types of chronic leukemias. That being said, bone marrow transplantation is a complex therapy, a therapy that risk increases with age, a therapy that is very extensive, time-intensive, and in some ways life-altering. So we tend to use that therapy for those individuals that we think myelofibrosis is likely to be life-threatening in the near future, and we think the individual is strong and hardy enough to really benefit from bone marrow transplantation. The majority of patients with myelofibrosis fall somewhere in the middle between these two extremes, with either our current therapies or experimental therapies. Amongst our current therapies, the one that is, we only have one FDA-approved therapy for myelofibrosis, one that Dr. Verstovchak and I were involved with testing and developing, which is one that was called ruxolitinib, or Jakafi. This medicine is a medicine that helps to block one of the steps in the biology of the disease that we think leads to problems with the illness, and that step is the mutation in JAK2, or the overactivity of the protein that we know is JAK2. That medicine has particularly been effective in helping people who have very enlarged spleens have their spleens reduced in size and benefit in terms of how they feel. It's helped individuals that have lost a lot of weight with the disease gain weight. It's helped individuals who are very symptomatic with the disease feel significantly better and improve their fatigue. And it's also shown in people who have advanced myelofibrosis, it probably helps to help these individuals live longer with the disease as well. There are other therapies we have used in the past. Most of the non-experimental therapies or non-Jakafi therapies are relatively modest in terms of how much they help. There have been medicines that shrink the spleen a little, such as hydroxyurea. There have been some medicines that have helped a little bit with anemia, medicines such as Procrit or thalidomide or lenalidomide. But there's a good reason there aren't other approved therapies other than ruxolitinib. Many of the therapies we've had in the past aren't very helpful. There are many experimental therapies, other JAK2 inhibitors being tested, that are an alphabet soup of names to give you at this moment, but medicines that are looking to see are they the same or might increase the benefits patients experience with ruxolitinib. There are combination studies being done in many centers, MD Anderson, Mayo Clinic, and others, looking at ruxolitinib with other medicines to see whether they can be more effective, or trials looking at new ways to try to block the biology of this disease so that patients may have better opportunities. So the future, I think, is very encouraging. We have many more therapies now than we did 5 years ago, and I think that we are learning a great deal and are testing some interesting areas. Now, as a second set of comments in today's discussion, they asked me to address, how do you care for your loved one with myelofibrosis? Now, this is really a key and a challenging area. And I'd say that there's a few things. One, in general, one of the challenges of having a disease like myelofibrosis is having a disease that people in general, most of the friends, family members, coworkers, people at church, really don't understand very well. You know, if your loved one is affected with breast cancer or lung cancer or lymphoma, people have some idea of kind of how to frame such an illness, what to expect. They have someone else they've known. They know how to put that into their understanding. When you have a disease like myelofibrosis, realistically, most people have never heard of it. So it is one of the difficulties myelofibrosis patients face is some degree of isolation. You know, their friends don't necessarily know how serious this is. They don't know how to interact with them. There is some reluctance there. Half the people they meet are going to think that their disease is much more life-threatening than it is or much more immediate. Others will tend to think that it's not a big deal. And that causes a stress for the individual. And being loving and supporting as you help them is the key. Clearly, you're demonstrating by being on this teleconference today both your tremendous support for the individual, but your energy and enthusiasm to become educated about the disease so that you can play a greater role in helping your loved one. Next, I would say that the questions I get asked most frequently by caregivers of patients with myelofibrosis are really two key things, nutrition and activity. Is there anything first that my loved one should be eating more of or eating less of by having this illness? And the short answer to that is no. We know that it's a disease associated with weight loss. We know that that's in part because the disease burns more calories and that the spleen presses on the stomach. But we cannot associate that specifically with a specific nutritional need or supplement that has to be overcome. We do know that calories are important. If people are under-eating, it's important that they're eating. Does it have to be perfectly balanced? To be honest, if they're losing weight, it's more important that they're eating calories than it being perfectly balanced. Two, the issue of activity. Particularly with the issue of the large spleen, people will ask, boy, do I need to avoid them having any activity? Should they avoid walking? Should they be resting more? And the short answer is that one, the spleen in this disease tends to be fairly sturdy. We don't think that there is a great risk of rupture with spleen in this disease, which is very different than an enlarged spleen from, let's say, mononucleosis or mono, the viral illness, which can make the spleen prone to rupture. So in general, we don't have activity restrictions. In fact, we encourage patients to be active, and that exercise and activity, certainly under the direction of their physician, does help with fatigue and other aspects of the illness. So that in a nutshell, and I look forward to the question session at the end, but I know Carolyn has a very packed agenda with some really wonderful experts to talk about other resources for caregivers, and we'll hand the call back to her.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Mesa, for just a wonderful presentation and really for identifying the new treatment options and as well as just the kind of questions that you're frequently asked that people are concerned about in terms of just the activity and nutrition and trying to normalize this experience as much as possible. Thank you. Our next speaker is Dr. Laurel Northaus. And Dr. Northaus is Mary Lou Willard French Professor of Nursing, the University of Michigan School of Nursing. And she's going to address taking on the role of caregiving, what research tells us about caregivers, and managing family, friends, partners, and traditions. I'm now going to turn the program over to Dr. Northaus.
Thank you, Dr. Besser. I'm happy to be on this call today. And during my time, I briefly want to cover three points. First, I want to clarify who is a caregiver. Second, I'll discuss the process of becoming a caregiver. And then third, I'll just give you a few tips for managing your role as a caregiver. So let's start with who is a caregiver. So we believe that a caregiver is anyone who provides physical or emotional care, or both, to a person who is ill, but the person is not paid to provide the care that they give. In healthcare, we often use the term family caregiver. The word family, though, we broadly define to include relatives, friends, or even neighbors. Caregivers do not have to be blood relatives. In many areas, they are not. According to national surveys, about two-thirds of the time, the family caregiver is the spouse or partner of the person who is ill. But more and more, we are seeing adult children take on the role of caregiver. National surveys also indicate that most caregivers are women. However, the number of male caregivers is also increasing. One other point I would like to make is that caregivers are emotionally affected by the patient's illness. They are not isolated from the stress of the illness. And because of that, patients and caregivers are both affected in some way by the illness, and they need to work together to manage it. And I'll get to that in just a few minutes. I want to shift now and just briefly discuss the process of becoming a caregiver. Some of you have come into the caregiver role gradually. Your loved one may have developed symptoms slowly, and as a result, a few tests were done, and so it took time. It's more of a gradual process. For others of you, it may have happened more suddenly, and whether the process that you entered occurred gradually or suddenly, the one thing that most caregivers have in common is that the diagnosis brings on an unexpected change in their lives. And as a result, caregivers seldom have a chance to get their own lives in order prior to becoming a caregiver. So it's the unexpected nature of the illness and the uncertainty that it creates that often can cause stress in the lives of a caregiver. One other thing is that because of the process of becoming a caregiver is that many caregivers feel unprepared to provide the care that's expected of them. As Dr. Mesa said, they're trying to figure out how to manage nutrition and exercise. And so caregivers are often uncertain. I'm a caregiver, but what does that mean? What do I need to do? And also in some settings, as a patient becomes more ill, more is expected of the caregiver, and they often are unsure how to give complex care in the home. I want to point out it's not just the physical care that's stressful for caregivers, but also the emotional care can be stressful. The illness can cause many fears, intense emotions in the ill person, and it's often difficult for family caregivers to know how to respond. For example, some caregivers may wonder, is it good to have the person discuss their fears? Is it better to distract them from thinking about the illness? So it's hard for caregivers to know how to deal with strong feelings that myelofibrosis can generate in either the caregiver or their loved ones with the illness. So caregiving is a process that doesn't end once treatments are over. The ongoing nature of the illness involves the caregiver for a longer period of time. So in the few minutes that remain, I want to just give you six quick tips about your role as a caregiver. And the first one, it's that it is very important for caregivers and patients to work as a team to manage the illness. Now, while that may sound like common sense, the idea is that because both people are affected by the illness, they both need to work together. And working as a team means using supportive communication with one another, trying not to be critical. It's very hard when patients and caregivers are critical of one another when they're trying to manage the illness. And even if you have different styles for doing things, it's important for patients and caregivers to find that common ground or use more give and take in the relationship so they can really be effective in managing the illness. The second tip is try to maintain hope in spite of the seriousness of the illness. You may wonder, how do I do that? Well, here's a few things that others have mentioned to us. You try to surround yourself with positive people who support you because hope is contagious. And as you may know, not all of our family members and friends are helpful. So trying to maintain hope means trying to spend time with those who are more hopeful and limit the time with those who are not. Another way to maintain hope is to try not to let the illness consume you. Even though some patients and caregivers think they need to think about it all the time, manage it, and so forth, it's really important if you can try not to be consumed and as much as possible plan pleasant activities in your life to bring joy in your life in spite of the illness. The third tip I want to mention is to try to find meaning and purpose in the illness and in your role as a caregiver. In some families, they find that the illness draws them closer together or it helps them to appreciate one another more. And some patients have said to us and caregivers that they learn to appreciate life in general more. They choose to work less or to find ways to enjoy life as much as possible. And what we have found in our own research is that the more that patients and caregivers are able to find some meaning in the illness, and others can't give you that meaning, it's something you discover for yourself, the better quality of life and the more you're able to cope with the stress of the illness. A fourth tip is that it's important for caregivers to maintain their own health and a healthy lifestyle. We find in our studies that caregivers often think about the patient's health only. They neglect their own health. For example, they may be sure that the patient has the healthy food to eat, and they may find fast foods or something really simple, so it's not taking so much time. But it's really important for caregivers to keep themselves healthy. And I think Dr. Palos is going to talk about that a little bit more, so I won't go into too much more detail. But do want to say that sometimes caregivers feel guilty when they do take this time for themselves, but it's really important that caregivers take a break when they can from caregiving. And I know your situations may differ in terms of the continuum that Dr. Mesa mentioned, but no matter what, you need to try to build in time. And I think it's important for the patient to understand that caregivers also need time to take a break. And if they can't get out, just a break to go read a book or work on a hobby or something. And the fifth tip is to try to keep the lines of communication open with one another. Sometimes when patients and caregivers hide their feelings, and they do this so that the other person doesn't worry. But when they hide feelings, it makes it more difficult for them to get support and give support to one another. So I would encourage you to try to keep your lines of communication open. The last tip is that it's really important for caregivers and patients to learn to live with uncertainty. Uncertainty is a normal part of the myelofibrosis experience, and it's important to get information that helps to reduce uncertainty, how to manage these bothersome symptoms. And I also just want to mention that when you feel uncertain, that's not a sign that you're not coping well. It's just a part of the chronic illness experience. So with that, I'd like to turn the talk back to Dr. Messner.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Northhouse. That was really just an amazing presentation, and also just all those wonderful tips that you provided for everybody to think about. Those are really wonderful. I know we'll want to talk about them some more during the Q&A, so thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Guadalupe Palos. And Dr. Palos is a clinical research manager at the University of Texas, MD Anderson Cancer Center, Division of Medical Affairs, Department of Cancer Survivorship. Now, Dr. Palos is going to address coping with holidays, special occasions, anniversaries and birthdays, long-distance caregiving, and self-care and stress management tips. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Palos.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. Today, as my colleagues have discussed so well, our discussion focuses on an important condition, myelofibrosis. And because it is a chronic illness, such as diabetes, it must be dealt with on a daily basis over a period of time. Thus, patients, caregivers, and families must realize the importance of continuing to live a normal life as much as possible, especially during significant occasions such as our birthdays, anniversaries, or holidays. Our two physicians gave an excellent overview of the disease and the treatment options. They also discussed the critical role patient-provider-family communication has in obtaining optimal treatment and symptom management. And Dr. Northhouse gave us an excellent definition of a caregiver and ways to manage a caregiver's health as well as the patient's health. So as we've heard, caregivers face many challenges, and they often struggle on a day-to-day basis to keep up with the routine care for a loved one while working, maintaining a home, being a parent, and all the other roles that go along. So when special occasions and holidays that were once so treasured come up, the entire family may often regard these events as another source of hard work, worry, and effort. It is true that families often feel that they must keep up with the wonderful traditions associated with celebrating the holidays. However, in the midst of preparing for those special moments, families may find themselves taking on the additional roles and responsibilities, and they may have some conflicting feelings. They want to enjoy themselves, but at the same time, they're thinking, oh, this is extra work. So how can families, particularly caregivers, take the time to enjoy themselves during these special times when they're juggling so many balls at one time? So what I'm going to do in the next few moments is focus on three questions that may arise during the caregiving experience. The first is, how can I cope with and enjoy the special celebrations and holidays given the daily routine of caregiving? The second is, what is the best way to be a long-distance caregiver? The third is, how do I make the time to slow down and take care of myself without feeling guilty? Let's begin with, what is long-distance caregiving? Let me ask those of you on the call, the listeners, to close your eyes for a moment and picture a loved one or a friend who may live in your home or another part of the city or in the neighborhood. So what types of things come to your mind? Do you wonder how their daily activities are going on? Are they healthy? Are they living a good life? What new things are happening? These are normal thoughts when we think of someone who doesn't live with us so closely sometimes. Now shift those thoughts again to someone that may live far from you again, but this time they're ill. You may have the same thoughts: are they living a good life? Are they healthy? How are their daily routines going? But now they're under the umbrella of concern. You're concerned about that ill person. Now, during this brief exercise, you may have pictured a loved one who is living with myelofibrosis at this moment. And for those of you who live with or close to that individual, those questions can be answered just by walking across the room or getting in a car or driving a short distance to see them. But what about those of you who do not live in close proximity to your loved one dealing with this experience? What do you do? It's not easy to walk across the room or drive this short distance, and that causes unique concerns, challenges, and circumstances for the caregiver, the patient, and the rest of the family. So we know that across our nation and our world, as Dr. Northhouse told us, there's an increasing number of caregivers that are providing help across the miles. There's no doubt that distance poses a barrier to caregiving, but there's growing evidence that even those who are long distance away provide essential support for their loved ones. Long-distance caregivers, for example, provide advice, financial support, they help with decision-making, and are critical in providing help during those crises that pop up. But being a long-distance caregiver can be stressful also, and challenging and yet rewarding. Oftentimes, there may be feelings of frustration or guilt. For instance, there may be thoughts of, I'm not doing enough. Perhaps there is fear or uncertainty, as we heard earlier, about their changes in their loved ones, their physical status, their mental health, and many other similar thoughts. The combination of these factors, being far apart, not being able to ask the questions, not seeing someone on a daily basis, not getting the answers to questions you may have, contribute to stress and distress of the long-distance caregiver. An additional factor that contributes to the stress is the dynamic nature of caregiving. We can expect that the roles and responsibilities of the caregiver will change throughout the cancer experience, or the myelofibrosis experience in this instance. It's not surprising that as those roles change, the emotional and physical health of a caregiver will also change. So I'd like to share, to begin with, a few practical tips that may help manage the stress with being a caregiver. First, do not hesitate to talk about your stress with someone you trust. It can be your spiritual leader, a counselor, others going through the similar experience, such as a support group. Just being able to verbalize feelings to someone else often gives immediate relief. Our next speaker will provide more details of this type of support. Second, if you're a visual person and you need to see your loved one and they live far away, set up a web camera so you can actually see your loved one and talk to them. Skype is an awesome way to keep in touch with a loved one across the miles, and if you have those wonderful little phones that everybody's using, the smartphones, that's another way you can try to do some face-to-face communication. Regular communication such as this will give you a good peace of mind. Third, another way to celebrate special occasions, and especially if someone is far away, is involve the entire family in creating collages or your own video clips of past holidays. This gives us snapshots of memories from the past, and you can share them with your loved ones. So even if you're not there physically or that person is not there physically, you are there in spirit. And these are nice to share even with those that are living with you in the same household. Fourth, be creative and explore and come up with new traditions. For example, maybe you're not going to be the person that cooks the dinner and takes care of everything the way you used to. Or maybe you're not going to be the individual who got out there and decorated the house the way you used to outside and indoors and everything. Maybe it's a time now to come up with new ways to celebrate and to treasure those holidays and special occasions. Fifth, as we heard earlier, it's important to speak to your physicians and your other providers, particularly if you have questions. You may worry at this time, are there certain foods people shouldn't be eating? Because maybe there's certain foods that you use during the celebration or that you that are traditional during the celebration. Maybe there's more activity. Perhaps you want to travel to go visit someone. Keep that communication open with your physician and your other providers, so that way you'll feel comfortable in what you're trying to plan and and you can enjoy yourself much better. So to move on, I'd like to also share a few strategies that you can use when you find yourself being perhaps in a long-distance caregiving experience. First of all, it's important to determine what can realistically be done. Create a stable and a realistic role as a caregiver, especially if you're a long-distance one. Be informed. We talked about how important it is to maintain close communication with your health team, your care team, and you can even schedule a regular time to call and talk to them if that's feasible. Determine the roles of the family. It's like Dr. Northouse said, it may not necessarily be a family member, a brother, an aunt, an uncle. It could be the neighbor that lives close to you. It could be someone from your church group. It could be someone from your tennis group or bowling team. You know, just someone who wants to be a part of the team and to help out. Fourth is set up a safety net. You can identify neighbors and friends or other relatives that can help monitor your loved one's condition. And again, this would be particularly important if you don't live with your loved one or if they're living far away. And this may sound like an easy thing that we take for granted, but just keep a list of helpful numbers. Make a list of everyone that's involved in the care of your loved one and keep that list and close, and then give it to as many different people that are on your team that you can, and that's your neighborhood team or your family team. And then also, if you are a long-distance caregiver, try to book your trips to your loved one's home ahead of time. So finally, and most important, it is important to keep tabs for the caregiver to keep tabs on their own physical and mental health. Make time for yourself. Be observant about your own health as well as you are being observant about your loved one's health. Encourage yourself as a caregiver, whether close or long distance, to take time for self-care and focus on your needs.
take that take a manicure, go get a pedicure, go get a massage, just go for a walk. Even just getting out of the house and walking around for a little bit will help give some relief. Remind yourself that by taking care of your own health, you and the person you are caring for will reap the benefits of being a happy and a healthy caregiver. And that may be even if it's across the freeways, the mountains, and the oceans. My colleagues and I look forward to hearing from you and the suggestions you may have for caregivers and those they care for. Thank you. Now I'm going to give the program back to Dr. Messner.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Palos, for just a wonderful, very wonderful presentation, and also the validation that you've given to everybody on the call that they have the right to take care of themselves. And also, we do now have time for questions and comments, but we also, because we recognize that there's a tremendous amount of expertise on this call, because many of you are caregivers on the call, we also, in addition to your asking questions, which you certainly can do, you also may wish to give us a comment of something that you've tried that's really worked, like a tip that you have found very helpful as a caregiver in helping someone, your loved one, with myelofibrosis. So I'm going to ask Stephanie to bring all of our speakers on board, and also to bring all our speakers on board, and then to explain to everybody how to queue up for questions, and we'll try to take as many of your questions as possible. If you don't get to ask a question, please know that you can also, of course, contact the staff at Cancer Care at 1-800-813-HOPE after the call today. Stephanie, I'm going to ask you to go ahead and explain to everybody how to queue up for questions.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Again, to ask a question, please press star then 1 on your touch-tone telephone.
And, you know, there's one issue that I know all of you have touched upon enormously, and that is, you know, the challenges of really being a caregiver in terms of sort of knowing what is the best thing to do in terms of both caring for many caregivers, their big focus is, of course, on the person with myelofibrosis and not always on themselves. So I'm going to ask Dr. Northhouse and Dr. Palos to address that, and I'm going to ask Dr. Fristovsek and Dr. Messa also to weigh in on this as well. Dr. Northhouse, could you begin?
Well, I think it's important to keep in mind that, as I mentioned, the caregiver also experiences stress associated with this role, and that they really do need to take care of themselves and look for ways that they can maintain their own health. And, you know, one thing that it sounds like it might be stressful from the conversation is what to tell other people about your loved one's illness. And maybe the panel can get to that issue as well, because I wonder if there's a couple of quick sentences in easy-to-explain language that would help the caregiver explain to a relative friend or coworker at work what their loved one has, and to sort of, put that topic to a rest and in any confusion that might go with it. But maybe we can come back to that one. So I think it's just important they need to recognize that they're affected by the illness, and it's important to do things, whatever they may choose, to be helpful to them to deal with it.
That's an excellent point, and we will come back to that, because how do you tell others? That's an excellent, the whole issue of disclosure. Dr. Palos?
Mm-hmm. Thank you. That's an excellent question. One of the things that I've had caregivers tell me is that, I'm a caregiver because I saw my mother taking care of her mother, and I saw my auntie taking care of them, and they did a beautiful job, and they were always there. So it kind of sets up the caregiver to a gold standard, and the gold standard is to always be doing the best and to always be sacrificing. And that's very hard to do sometimes, especially given the world that we live in right now. So it is good to keep in mind that you had role models and mentors and coaches that showed you how to be a caregiver. But remember, too, everyone's world is different, so the roles and responsibilities are going to be different. So it's, you need to reflect on your own situation and say, okay, how can I become a healthy caregiver? Because if you're not healthy, that's going to have an impact on the patient, and it's also going to have an impact on your family. And as we've already heard from our two physicians, myelofibrosis is a very challenging disease to deal with over a period of time. So you want to be as strong as possible, not only physically, but also spiritually and mentally. So take time. That's all I can say is take time, because I've heard caregivers just say, oh, I don't have time for that. Oh, I want to do this, but I don't have time for that. Take the time.
And Dr. Vistovsek and Dr. Nessa, do you want to add to that?
Go ahead, Serge.
So in this particular situation with myelofibrosis being so debilitating in some situations to a patient, it is very important to understand that there is certainly a place for a team effort here, and everybody involved, either from the medical side or from the family side, has a role in supporting the patient and supporting patients not just in receiving proper therapy, but in supporting patients in everyday activities, in providing quality of life and understanding what is going on and why things are happening. And this is what we try to emphasize with this particular disease, where we are facing such difficulties, that the best can come up when everybody participates and everybody understands the roles and takes this seriously and has the opportunity to contribute.
Perhaps I might add to really some wonderful comments that have been made. You know, one of the things about myelofibrosis is that, you know, the journey sometimes, fortunately and unfortunately, can be a long journey, you know. And, I mean, there are times when we have a loved one who is ill, who has a very rapidly evolving disease, advanced pancreatic cancer or other things, and it's a very short, very intensive time where we lay everything about ourselves down and are in caregiver mode 150% 24/7. And with myelofibrosis, you know, fortunately, it's not really that sort of situation frequently. It can be a lot of work, but it can be a much longer journey or period of time. So all of these issues that have been discussed in terms of having the caregiver role being one that is sustainable and one where you yourself are not being burnt out, but really can be a resource for your loved one and a positive influence upon them as well is very important. You know, so taking care of yourself is very important, but I think really also some degree of pacing is very important as well with this difficult disease. The second thing which I had heard raised, you know, how do you communicate with others about your loved one? Again, it is a disease that I think most accurately we would call a chronic leukemia, you know, and I would simply describe it, if I had an afflicted family member with myelofibrosis, is I would tell them that they have a chronic leukemia, a blood condition that, you know, can impact how they feel and can severely affect their blood counts. I would try to keep it simple, but I think I would use the term chronic leukemia because it implies appropriately that it's, you know, it's a serious disease.
That's very helpful, because actually finding the words to describe when one has a type of cancer that's unusual or that's rare, it's hard sometimes to find the accurate words to describe it to others so that one can just help them understand what you're experiencing.
Carolyn, can I just add on to that a minute? I think the other thing that's challenging when people are talking with others, you know, friends or family, they often expect that if these friends or family are really interested, they will ask the person with the illness or the caregiver about it. But often others don't know how to ask that question, and they don't know if you even want to talk about it. So I often find that it's the patient and the caregiver who would help. It helps if they bring up the topic. For example, say my loved one is dealing, as Dr. Messner said, with a chronic leukemia. And that lets the other people know, okay, I will talk about it. I'll mention the words. And I think that everybody can just sort of relax a little bit about it. But often there's this dance. Oh, should I ask? Should I not ask? Should I tell? Shouldn't I tell? And then, I hate to say it, but it's often the caregiver and the patient who are the ones to bring it up, and even though they would expect others to ask that of them.
Excellent point. And Dr. Palos, did you want to add as well?
Well, I was just thinking about some of the patients and caregivers that I have met. And I know that sometimes people want to communicate about the conditions and what's going on, but I've also had folks that are very private and don't want to talk about it. And also with some cultural groups, you know, cancer is still considered a stigma, whether it's a blood condition or, you know, a chronic leukemia. So I think, too, it's good to find out, you know, who, or kind of assess who wants to know about this, you know, and how much do they want to know. And I think once a caregiver or a patient can kind of gauge that, that will help. But then, and it's like Dr. Northaus just said, also, people don't know whether or not to ask. So because this person may be a private person, it's not just that they don't want to ask to be rude about the, you know, what kind of condition they have, but perhaps they know this person well enough to know they don't share their feelings or they don't like to talk about their health. So it's you really have to think about how you're going to bring up that topic and how people are going to talk about it with family members and friends.
That's really so important. And I the issue is that some people are more private than others, and the issue, that's both for the person living with myelofibrosis. It also could be true for friends who may think who may be private themselves and then don't ask the questions. So it could be many different people may have different ways of communicating in general, and then everybody cares, but it's hard for them to kind of express their concern and care.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really so. It's really, it's sometimes, so everyone may be caring, but they may not be able to find the words to say that they care. So that's can be quite challenging. Stephanie, do you want to explain to the audience again how to queue up for questions?
Again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone.
I have a question for our panel members. I think one of the things that I heard that stayed with me is that this is a chronic disease and that patients and caregivers somewhat need to pace themselves. And I hadn't thought about that. I know that Dr. Northaus said, you know, to work as a team and get, you know, everyone involved and throughout the experience. But I'm just wondering if there's some ways that an entire family could kind of pace themselves throughout this caregiving experience. Especially, like, I think what we were talking about, sometimes there may be decreased activity or, you know, appetite needs that come up. Are there any suggestions or anything for how a team would pace themselves?
Dr. Messer, Dr. Vistosek?
Serge?
Well, this is a chronic condition, and as Dr. Messer mentioned, it is slowly progressing. It is not something that happens overnight, and people involved, family members, do notice things over time as they change. Even if they are not involved directly, they would notice the physical change in a person with the body change in terms of very big abdominal distension with the loss of weight. There will be those questions that we discussed. They will be asked within the family, and people will need to be informed, and everybody will have its role to the different extent. The communication between the family members, understanding of what is happening with the loved one, and engagement to different level is usually what I see in my practice. By and large, it is not up to one caregiver usually. It is family involvement to help involve the person live through this the process and help as much as they can. Not everybody has the same ability or time, but in general, it requires family engagements, and it may change the communication style or even emotional involvement between the family members when one loved is affected so much.
Thank you very much. That's very helpful. And Dr. Massa, do you want to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think I would add, again, one, I think it is important to engage the patient as well in this. You know, I mean, I think the process of, you know, in particular with this disease, I think something we've learned very strongly is, you know, trying to keep that individual up, active, trying to live as normal a life as they can is key. You know, so I think part of being the caregiver role is sometimes being a bit of a cheerleader and a bit of a coach as well, you know, where I think we would probably not serve our loved one's best needs if we were overly doting or we took support to the degree that it adds to the further debilitation of the patient. You know, so having them be active, having them be up and about, having them walk as best as they can. You know, if your doctor thinks a walking plan is good, walking along with them, I think those things are helpful both in terms of keeping energy up, both for yourself and for your loved one that's afflicted. You know, but I think a little bit of tough love sometimes can be good as well. You know, in that it's a disease that fatigue is natural, and that fighting against the fatigue is probably the best thing we can do. Whereas just completely wholeheartedly, giving into the fatigue and becoming less active probably can be very counterproductive.
I want to thank all of our speakers. You've been just an amazing team. We want to bring you back for a future program. You've just been terrific. And I want to thank all of you who've been listening on the program today and all of you who've actually sent us some online questions as well that we've been using during the call today. I also want to just remind all of you that although the program is an hour education workshop, that we have many services and support for you from Cancer Care. And I just want to review those with you. Cancer Care, has a staff of 45 master's level trained oncology social workers, and we're here to provide a host of free services for you. We're someone that you can talk to about your concerns, so our social workers can do that. They just can talk with you, offer you counseling support. We also offer practical and financial assistance. We offer a number of different support groups as well. We also, of course, have these workshops, and we have many publications and materials that you can order from Cancer Care. So most importantly, I would not want anyone to think that you're alone in coping with myelofibrosis. Now, you can contact Cancer Care at 1-800-813-HOPE or visit our website at www.cancercare.org. And remember, we're simply a phone call or a mouse clip away. We're right here for you, and please take advantage of these services. I want to thank all of you for participating today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may now disconnect and have a wonderful day.